Welcome to the Color Cast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We're the Coloristos. I'm Juan Salvo, an online editor and colorist in New York City.
And I'm Jason Myris, a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles.
And I'm Josh Petok, a colorist also in Los Angeles. And this week, what we want to talk about is scopes. So waveforms, vector scopes, histograms, all the above, and how it can help you actually produce a better grade. I guess I should start off by saying, what do we all use? What do you guys use for a scope?
I've got actually a few scopes. So I've got some Tektronix around the shop here. I've got some leaders. And we've also, what I use in my room right now is, actually I've got the Blackmagic Ultrascope set up on a computer monitor, so it just gives it a nice display. And I've also got scope box sitting around as well that I use to test or to do particular kinds of scoping. And then additionally, you know, I regularly use software scopes and certain tools to do a little kind of on-the-spot analysis of things.
Yeah, I'm also using a tech scope, a 7020, and I just use it. I use both the actual scope view with the scope, and I have an external monitor as well. I really prefer the external monitor as well, just because it's so much easier to see the image on a big screen. It's a, you know, maybe like a 13-inch LCD panel, but it makes a big difference.
Sure, it's a lot more detail.
I am using the internal scopes in Scratch, primarily the Parade, and then I often have the vector scope open, especially, you know, just to double check things like skin tones. And then I have an FSI 2460, and I use its internal scopes sort of as an external scope to Scratch to double check things. And I find that they're quite close. But one thing that would be nice, and I'm actually, you know, currently working on, is how to get a set of nice external scopes going. So I would say a while ago I saw an Omnitek OTR 1000. I've been trying to figure out the $500 version of that. So, well, yeah.
Let's talk briefly. I think there's a lot. It used to be like if you wanted a set of scopes, you were going to spend $5,000 at the very, very least.
Oh, yeah.
It was a hardware device. I mean, they went up to, I mean, decent Tektronix could be $20,000-$30,000 for something that, for example, or a leader that would support, you know, RGB and would support multiple frame rates and resolutions. But nowadays, a lot of people are using these sort of hybrid hardware software products where you have a couple of them. It's basically an input board that fits into a computer, and then you run a program that basically rasterizes the scope interface. And so, like, Ultrascope is one of those. Scopebox, which works with a lot of third-party apps, is another one, and there's a couple of others. And these significantly reduce the cost of entry to these things. So basically, when you're using those scopes, you're getting the performance of a hardware scope because you're using dedicated hardware. You're not sucking up CPU cycles that you use when you're using a software scope in like Scratch or something. And you get it, you run it on a separate machine, so you're not using up system resources, and you get something that's sort of rasterizing onto a computer display, and is kind of a more cost-effective solution for that functionality.
Jason, do you see a significant performance hit on Scratch when you're using the scopes, like you do with the Resolve?
You know what? There's maybe a minor one, but not enough to get in the way. But what I'll say, you know what the larger thing is? I would say performance is a big deal. And let's say that you're doing something very extreme or that might be pushing your system. Like maybe you're doing a 4K project or whatever might take you to task. The other big thing is the screen real estate. You know, so you've got the performance aspect, but then the other big thing is just, you know, do you have room? And I would say that in Resolve, you know what I did is I would have the waveform, I would have the Parade up covering up my power grades and stills area. I would have it right there in the center. And then if I needed to get to a still or a power grade, I'd have to move the scope. And I know that actually with, doesn't Resolve do a dual monitor situation now where you can move the scopes over, right?
Yes.
And that's really helpful. That's a big deal, I think.
Some people I've noticed use these little teeny tiny 10-inch screens too, which are like a perfect size for a scope. Another thing that I've seen people do is you can change the orientation of your monitor. So you can have more of like a vertical, like maybe like a 22-inch vertical screen. So you can kind of lay the scopes from Resolve all, you know, you can stack them all up and down, which is kind of a different aesthetic to it. But you know, it's cool that there's so many different options, so many different ways you can visualize what you're looking at.
Well, in Resolve version 8 and under, you had the scopes were kind of, each scope version was independent in an independent window. Now they're all, four of them are in the same window, so you have to kind of adjust the whole window. You don't have the ability to sort of adjust each individual one the way you did before.
Right.
That's something, you know, we can talk, like, you know, all of these software scopes offer some features that others don't. So, for example, the scope box interface is very, very customizable, where the Ultrascope interface is less so. You know, and with the hardware scopes, there's very little customizability in the interface, although you do have kind of rapid access to certain features, because you usually have the hardware scopes, you have dedicated buttons for certain functions. So you can, for example, on the leaders, and I think the Tektronix as well, you can do a four-way split and have four different interfaces up on the monitor at the same time, and then you can do a quick jump to each one, so you can basically blow up each interface to look at it directly on the scope itself or on an external monitor.
Yeah, I kind of think like the hardware scopes is like having a hardware control surface where you can quickly pop between different things. You can compare different views to one another. If somebody's behind you and says, I want to know if those blacks are clipped, you can quickly just pop open the waveform and zoom into it and say, no, everything is absolutely great there.
Yeah, and you know, or having, for example, I have like two 27-inch monitors for like my GUI, and then when I'm in grading mode, when I'm in resolve mode, generally, I'll have the second monitor will actually be feeding the rasterize of my scope. So that gives me enough screen real estate to kind of be able to see in detail within each window, be able to see an image that's going to give me feedback and give me the information that I need to know.
Yeah, I mean, when you get down to it, it's kind of like the question sometimes comes up too. It's like, should I use a scope or should I not use a scope? And I always like to think of it as, it's like the map for where you want to go. If you feel pretty confident driving where you're going to go, then you usually don't need a map. But, you know, it's just more information that just helps you to visualize what's going on. Sometimes you don't, you know, you get tired, or you can't see exactly what the problem is. And just looking over at a scope, you can instantly see, oh, well, I can see the green channel has a little bit more in the shadows or something like that. And I'm going to balance those out.
I find it really useful for just seeing where my clipping is, where my, you know, sometimes I'll have things where I'll have raw formats or log formats, and it'll be hard to judge if there's a hard clip on something or where exactly that clip is occurring. And on the scopes, I can quickly see, okay, this is flat here. This is where the end of my signal is. This is as much information as I have. And it's just a quick reference. That's what it is. It's a reference device. Right. You know, you're looking at it, you're referring to it to sort of diagnose things or to give you more detailed feedback about particular specific issues.
On the Tektronix, there's one awesome feature that's called Bright Up. I don't know if you use that, but what it will do is it will tell you, it'll give you kind of like a little indication that there's certain areas that are out of your gamut or that are out of brightness level. So without actually having to even look at the scope, you can go, oh yeah, this is areas that I have to be concerned about, or I don't really care about any, like the pings of highlights or something like that. I don't care if those go out of legal. I'm just going to clip them. So
yeah, on the leaders, I used to, for the final online, when I was doing like a review pass, this was when you really had to deal with every legal issue. I would set like a fairly conservative settings on the alarms, and then I would just have an audible alarm, and I would run through the show once and just listen for an alarm. If I heard an alarm, I'd go and look, let's see what's going on here. And, you know, usually it's a gamut problem or something, and tweak that issue and then play through. So if I got through the whole show without an alarm, I knew I was set.
What about this? You know, a lot of the scopes that you guys are talking about are very high-end tools. What if we were to sort of march our way from, you know, inexpensive options to, you know, those scopes you're talking about, just so people have a little bit of a playing field of what's popular?
Sure. The nice thing is, like, there isn't, in terms of pure functionality, it's not like you're getting a night and day difference between the more cost-effective solutions and the cheap and the more expensive solutions. So, you know, there's really, it's not a hard sell on getting the most expensive hardware. You know, you're not going to see a quantitative difference in terms of how much you're able to evaluate something on the less expensive software-based system. So that's a good thing. And then in terms of cost, you are talking about, you're still talking about a little bit of cost, because best case scenario, you could run something like a scope box on, say, a Mac Mini, which is going to cost you like $700 or something, and then have a you'd have to get a Thunderbolt input device, so something like, you know, one of those new Blackmagic Thunderbolt I/O things that are like $200. So you're looking at like $900 plus the software. So you're somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,000 is kind of the lowest cost that you're going to get, including hardware and software, and you know, basically the setup that you need in order to be able to use that as a scope device.
Yeah, and for $1,000, I think that's a pretty smoking deal.
That's insane. I mean, it's something that's going to be really limited. So you're only going to be able to do 422 on it. You're only going to be able to, you know, depending on the horsepower, you may not get full frame playback in Scopebox. You may not be able to have as many windows open as Scopebox. You know, so there's limitations, but you're going to get something that's going to be functional, and it's going to take the resources that you're otherwise using in software scopes and shift it over to another device, so you're not tying up your grading system or your editing system on the scope functionality.
Yeah, Jason, you have a you were saying that you have a Flanders monitor, and the scopes built into that don't update very frequently, maybe every 8 frames, 15 frames or something like that.
Yeah, they're slightly behind. And so what I would say is that overall, where they work really well, you know, when you sit on a frame and then you're making adjustments. And so it works really nicely there. But definitely during playback, you can feel that it's a touch behind.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, you have to sort of take that into account. But, you know, in general, it's good. And what I would say, if there was anything about the Flanders, you know, that I would say I'd love to correct, is just it'd be nice if it was bigger, you know. And so the Flanders doesn't need to be bigger in and of itself. What I need to do is get real external scopes. And so that's what I'm working on.
Right. You know, I mean, I don't think that having the views actually be choppy or anything is that big of a deal. It's really when you're parked on a frame that you're really looking at the scopes.
Well, I'll say that that's one place where if you're doing online, you're doing finishing and you're doing like stuff that needs to pass broadcast quality control, then yeah, you do need the real time, because sometimes I've had many, many issues where I've had things that were just wrong on one or two frames, and it would be something you would miss if you don't have that
right
sort of frame for frame refresh rate.
Yeah, that is a good point.
That's a minority of the use case, right? For most people, that's not what they're doing. That's just, and if you're doing that, you're probably in a house that has real hardware, dedicated scopes that, you know, Tektronix Lead or whatever, that are designed for that purpose. And are priced accordingly.
Yeah. Well, the one thing too, and I would say that this has a huge bearing on whether people invest in scopes or not, is that with TV, it's really critical. And so for the past several, shall we say decades, you know, having scopes was a really important aspect of your ability to do, you know, legal output for television. But what's going on now is with things like the web, while you still don't want to just completely be egregious, you know, be way outside of gamut or, you know, your Luma and stuff like that, I guess the big deal is that the emphasis on the criticality of having scopes, let's say, or expensive scopes versus something that just gets the job done, is diminishing a little bit with the fact that many new outlets for work are appearing. So the web, definitely for film, that's very important. But there's a lot of places where, you know, people who are doing color grading don't have that rigor required, like for television or say high-end film.
Yeah, and additionally, there the in those situations, the benefit of the scopes is not so much about like the technical qualification of whether something's legal or allowed or not. It's about getting feedback in terms of what's available in your image. Where's the clipping happening? What are you losing? What are you gaining? Where are your blacks sitting? You know, that's sort of grading feedback, even that you can build on, that you can grade, you know, use as a guide for your grading.
Definitely. Well, I mean, I would say that would be the one place where it would last for everyone, wouldn't it? I mean, essentially, that's what I look for scopes for mostly. Like, one of the big things they help me with is if I have a tremendous, like, let's say I have two things going on. I have odd lighting in a room, and I have a tremendous color cast, let's say due to a window. One of the things that's helpful, and actually James Wicks talks about trying to find out what is that scarf, you know, what color is it actually? And so, you know, in his restoration process, he's got these tremendous color casts, and I think he was using scopes probably a lot to figure out, you know, what the color of the scarf was actually, even though it looked yellow, is actually blue, you know, or something like that. And so guys, I think before we get into actual options that people can purchase, whether they're software or hardware, we should go over the fundamental waveforms that people will be looking at on their scopes. And so maybe we start with the fundamental three, we'll call it, which would be your waveform, the classic waveform, which is a single composite view of your entire signal. And then you can break that out into a red, green, and blue representation of that, so you can see the color channels independently. And then ancillary to that would be a vector scope view, which gives you a set of points for red, green, and blue, and essentially allows you to see what the, I guess, the maximum saturation is within your signal.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think of it, you know, kind of as your signal being components, you know, components of your signals, you have the red, green, blue component of your signal. You know, you look at them all together, that's your waveform, that's your composite signal, which gives you the overall level of everything. So, you know, you're looking at things from 0 to 100, you know, that full range of what's available to you. And that can be represented in IRE values or in MV millivolt values, or even in binary values. So 0 to 255 or 0 to 1024. And that's the composite signal. And then a direct offshoot of that is your parade signal, which just basically can take the RGB signal or can take a YUV signal and separate it out into each component signal. So you can see the luminance signal or the red signal, the green signal, the blue signal, or the luminance signal, the difference of red, the difference of blue signal. And then the third scope, the vector scope, it just shows you the chrominance information. So it's not really worrying about luminance, since not really doesn't have a representation for how bright something is, but it's just telling you how saturated it is and what color it represents. And you can actually see, you know, on a vector scope, you'll see various color points for the different vectors, the different quadrants of color. And if you put up a set of color bars, for example, you would see, if it was properly set up, you would see all of those little color bars points being lined up with the exact vector of each color. So you'd have cyan, blue, magenta, red, green, so on.
And then from there, there's some other versions of sort of other views that have become really popular. So I guess, you know, now in things like Baselight and other applications, you've got Histogram, and that's also included in Resolve as well as Scratch and other programs. So what are some of the more modern ones beyond Histogram? Have you guys seen anything like variations of the fundamental three?
Well, I mean, if you guys remember in Color, they had that weird 3D visualization of your color.
Yeah, that was a cool one because it was basically representing in 3D space, representing the luminance value as well as the chrominance value. And that actually gave you a really good insight into what the gamut was, because you could see that kind of double triangle shape or that double cone shape that would tell you exactly what levels were allowed for color at which luminance level.
Yeah, and there's also on tech scopes, they have split diamond or arrowhead views, which are really good for, it's kind of the same idea as what the view in Color was doing, but it's specifically made to tell you if you're out of gamut or if you're out of a legal range.
Yeah, that's that's one of those things where you get into like the specialty scopes that are kind of tied with certain hardware manufacturers, that you get a particular kind of feedback, and it's not necessarily information that you couldn't glean some other way, but it's just a different way of displaying that information. That's a really great resource for kind of seeing gamut issues, because you can spot them right away on that. It's a really good representation for where you're going to run into gamut problems, which are probably, gamut is probably the thing that gets you the most in terms of broadcast safe and legalizing images.
Yeah, I think that the biggest problem with scopes is they're very confusing as far as a use case. In some senses, people believe I'm using this to figure out how to make my images look better. And then in another sense, you're using it to make sure that you're sending out legal images. So they're really used for those two things.
I think there's also one other use case, which is diagnosing technical problems. So, you can see we talked about display technologies and how they need to be calibrated. The scopes, you know, just let you see the kind of the raw signal information. So you're looking at a representation of what's actually in the signal without the bias of how the display is showing it. So it's a really great way of sort of knowing exactly what your signal represents.
I mean, I agree with that. I mean, that's very true. However, there's other things that only humans can perceive. Like, say, if there's a surround image, you could look at something on the scope and say, oh, well, the numbers tell me that this is red, but when you look at something with a different surround, you may say, oh, that doesn't really look red. It looks like this color. And I think other people watching a show too will say, oh yeah, well, yeah, of course that does look like this because it's surrounded by something else. So the numbers that are there on a scope, they're there pretty much to help you, but I guess you can't just use, you have to have a good monitor. That's what it comes down to. You have to,
I don't want to say it's a replacement for a good monitor. I'm saying it's in addition to a good monitor, what it's going to,
right.
You know, unlike a monitor, which you're always having to worry about, is this properly calibrated and how accurate is its display? You still have to worry about the, you know, scopes can go bad or whatever, but you don't have to worry about the accuracy so much of how the data is being displayed. Because you know that data is representing the value of the signal in a different dimension. So it's representing in terms of actual pixel positions, as opposed to representing in terms of what the pixel looks like. And so it gives you a perspective on it that isn't biased by our own human interpretation of how we perceive color.
And that's when it really helps when you're getting tired or you're just forced to do long sessions. The scopes can help keep you honest in terms of what you're seeing.
That's true to a degree. And it's also kind of, I mean, Josh, maybe you do this as well. When I'm going from shot to shot, balancing things sometimes, you know, after a long day, you start to get a little tired. You're not seeing the differences, or you're kind of getting your mind gets mushy a little bit. Your eyes get mushy. And it helps me at least to sort of be able to refer back to a set of parade scopes and look at, okay, here's where the balance is on this shot, here's where the balance is on that shot, this probably needs a little more green, this probably is a little cooler, whatever. It's a good guide for me to just kind of double check my own eyes.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the thing that I really like is I have a zoomed in view on the shadows of the RGB parade, which really help out if I'm having a problem matching up the, if there's any issues with the balance in the shadows. And that's a great way to just really quickly see, oh yeah, I can see there's a little bit of green in the shadows here. I need to bring that down a little bit. So that helps out a lot.
Let's describe that a little bit as a next step, because essentially, if you're doing anything that's, you know, say for legalization, so it helps you choose sort of the envelope for your signal. But then there's a sort of a famous thought that I think a lot of people run into when they are speaking with someone who understands how to look at a scope, and let's say they don't know how. And you guys maybe remember this early on in your careers when somebody says, oh yeah, I can see in the scope here there's a lot of blue in his shirt. And I think that's one of the first things that fascinated me. I was like, wait, where's the blue and where's the shirt?
Yeah.
So let's describe to people when they're looking at a waveform, and you know, this is a podcast, so we're a little limited, but when people say, let's say that there is blue in a crisp white shirt, what would they see in the scope that would help a person who understands a waveform see that?
Well, one trick I use, which is handy, is actually if you do the highlight view and resolve, for example, if you're using a qualifier to isolate something and you do the highlight view, it'll actually replace everything else with like a 50% gray. So if you're looking at that highlight viewed image on a vector scope, the vector scope, you can zoom in and you can see exactly which way that image is that you're qualifying is vectored towards. So you know exactly what color direction that image is in. So that's just a quick guide. But in order to do that, you really have to be able to isolate it. You know, the tricky thing is, if you're not experienced with scopes, it's really hard to sort of understand what you're seeing a lot of the time. So as you look at the waveform, for example, that the horizontal, you can imagine the horizontal line across that image being represented by the horizontal width of the image itself. But the vertical line does not represent the vertical image. It represents the luminance value, so the brightness level. And plots them out. So if you're looking at something that's in the middle of the width of the screen, that's going to be represented in the waveform by being in the middle of the width of the waveform. So that's kind of a good reference point to be able to tell, okay, this is what the object is that's being described in the waveform. I think Red Cine X actually has that Really cool function where if you're looking at something in the viewer and you kind of mouse over in the viewer, it'll highlight the same point or the relative point in the waveform. Have you seen that?
Yeah, definitely. That's a really nice feature. And I think I saw that in Nucota Film Master as well, I believe. And so the thing is that it's so useful. It's a surprise that it's not in a lot more products. You know, it really does help you analyze a shot.
I mean, I was just saying it's like, because that's a free download too. So if you can download that and sort of play around with it, that's a really good kind of teaching tool for understanding how this is represented and kind of figuring it out for yourself. Once you get the hang of it, you don't need that anymore. But having it there when you, especially if you're starting out and you don't really know how to use a set of scopes, that's a great way to kind of get the hang. It's like it's training wheels, you know?
One thing that I would say is that when I first discovered, you know, being able to analyze a waveform and understand, say, what the, you know, the color cast on a white shirt was, is what you're like exactly what you're describing, Juan, which is that realizing that a waveform is not just a distorted version of the video signal, you know, which is what it looks like. People see movement in the scope and they're like, but wait, that doesn't look like a person or a tree or a car. And what you realize is from left to right, you do have the horizontal axis is representative of the left to right in your image, but then the plotting of the values goes from dark to bright. And so essentially, if you have a person with a white shirt in the middle of your frame, you're going to see if they have essentially like a dark background, you'll see a large bump in the values represented by a set of peaks that would indicate that there is a bright white object, in this case the shirt, in the middle of your frame. And then from there, if you were to look at a parade, which breaks those out into red, green, and blue versions of the waveform, you'd see in the blue, for instance, that there was a lot of sort of high or white values. And so from there, you would be able to adjust, say, an RGB controller or a trackball to make those blue values come down in the highlights, essentially, which is what a white shirt would represent. And from there, this is the beginnings of how you neutralize an image using a scope. And so that's, I would say, a fundamental task of color grading, and a scope is a fundamental tool for that task.
I do agree on some level. And another thing that you kind of have to keep in mind is, again, you have to look at it with real eyes too. And like, let's say you're looking at that situation and you're looking at the scope, and you see, oh, this is really blue in this area. This guy's shirt has obviously got a blue tint to it. But let's say he's in a club or something like that, and there's blue lights all over the place. Well, yeah, of course his shirt's going to be a little bit blue because of the way the whole scene is illuminated. So sometimes the scope will tell you one thing, but you kind of have to have some common sense looking at it as well.
Yeah. So if you were to correct for that blue in that scenario with the blue lights, you'd end up actually balancing out all the blue lights. So everything would be balanced out.
Right. Right. And then you're getting into interpretation, which is a huge chapter that you can discuss as a colorist.
Not just that, but also stylistically, you know, you make certain decisions about what you want things to be.
Well, okay. I'll bring up a probably the most controversial thing that has to do with scopes, right? The eye line. Skin tones need to be on the eye line.
Don't open up that kind of worms.
Right?
Don't open up that kind of worms.
So, okay. Yeah, I went there. What are you going to do, right?
No. Well, see, I don't know if you, there was a huge thread on the cow about this. I mean, people have gotten in fisticuffs over this, but the eye line, it's only coincidental that it lines up with flesh tone, and it doesn't always line up with flesh tone,
right?
So it's not really meant for that, you know, like now it's sort of being applied for that, and people add it as the flesh line or whatever, but that may not be the best use for it.
Hey guys, yeah. let's define the eye line for our listeners who don't know.
The eye line is what most people think. There's a line, it looks like it's at about, say, what would you say, 10 o'clock?
Yeah, I mean, or, yeah.
11 10 o'clock.
It's like a 45 degree angle.
To the top left of the vector scope. And what people do is they use this one line that's there to kind of get an idea of where their skin tones should be. And some people are very religious about it. They say, my skin tones have to be on this line or else the whole thing is incorrect. And some people, actually, I think that Alexis Van Herkman had the best interpretation of it. He says, if your skin tones are, you know, not on that line, it's okay. It's just a guide to make sure you haven't gone out of crazy town, It's like it's just supposed to give you an idea of, okay, this is the general area where your skin tones should be.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like if you're far enough outside of that to matter, you should be able to see that. Like you know, it's not like,
right.
It's not such a precise position that it's really going to make make or break difference. The actual eye line itself is supposed to represent the eye axis, the color axis, and in the phase of like NTSC signal. This comes from the old days where like chrominance and luminance were sort of transmitted separately, and sometimes they would go out of sync, and so you'd end up with these shifts in color, and you'd have to adjust. Remember, you had to adjust phase in order to, you know, kind of get the colors right or whatever. And so that's where that indicator comes from. And if you have a set of bars, it'll line up a certain way. And I think they picked that particular line just as sort of being similar to flesh, because we film flesh a lot. Like there's a lot of footage of flesh, so it's a kind of a quick reference to sort of guide where your skin tone should be, and by extension, where your signal should be. Back in the analog days, where the chroma signal and the luminance signal were broadcast separately. But it's skin tones. I mean, it goes back to what you were bringing up with the shirt, Josh. I mean, it's gonna the where your skin tone should be depend upon what the overall tonality of the shot is, what the overall tonality of the scene is, what the lighting in the situation is. And so as a guide to exactly where your skin should be, I don't think it's a very good one. And a lot of modern waveforms don't even have it because they don't see the utility of it anymore.
In fact, I think when it was taken out of some of them, people just went ape shit. Sorry to lose our clean tag there, but it's pretty apropos for how everybody reacted when that one line was taken out from the vector scope.
Which vector scopes did that happen? Like, so for instance, there was a time when that officially happened on a number of products.
I think that it was not in a certain build of Resolve, if I remember correctly.
In fact, I don't think it's in the latest build. I don't think it's there.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that if you're not using it regularly, you wouldn't even notice it was missing, because it's not like you're referring to it. And then people who do kind of use it, of course, noticed immediately, but and were very upset about it because they felt lost. But if you've been using that thing for years and you know where it should be enough to know that it's not there, like shouldn't you be able to kind of judge it by, play it by ear, yeah, a little bit?
I would think so.
I mean, that comes down to, again, the idea of interpretation. You know, a lot of people, have this, what we'll call specific range that they feel like skin tones should reside in. But at the same time, and I think one of the big things is that, you know, people say that skin tones are sort of like the uncanny valley of color, you know? So there's this idea that, if you have the skin tones outside of a certain range, then you're no longer looking natural and human, regardless of how crazy stylistic, you know, you want to be. I actually was watching a movie last night. I actually saw Warrior, which ended up being really great on a number of levels, including color. And there is this interesting green color cast that they put around Nick Nolte's character, who is sort of the father in this movie. It's really interesting. It's got a very Matrix type tinge to it. But throughout the whole movie, green background or otherwise, the skin tones are rock solid. And I think they're doing that on purpose to make sure people don't get too weirded out, you know?
They absolutely do that on purpose. But, it, you know, it's like, you know, that's one of those things when you're grading that. Usually when you're grading features like that, you inevitably are doing qualifiers on skin tones because you always do kind of want to treat the skin less heavily than you would the atmosphere, because you can usually get away with a lot in the atmosphere and you can't get away with as much in the skin tone. So inevitably there's that qualifier that
I guess the other big thing is beyond skin tones, would you say that there's anything else that needs to be preserved in order for the interpretation of the scene to be natural? So what do you guys think about things like either grass or leaves, or one I was dealing with recently was brick, you know, like, because brick is a classic thing, you know, if you take brick and you make it purple, that's a problem. You know, and so is there any other sacred cows out there in your frame that you worry about?
When you're looking at a scope, one thing that you'll find very interesting is when you start looking at grass, you'll notice that grass is actually more yellow than it is green. So like a green is usually what, you know, a memory color, something that you in your mind decide that, you know, grass is green. But when you look at it on a scope, you will notice that it's usually got more yellow in it than it does green.
Yeah, that's a good point. The memory color. So essentially you'd have to pick out any items that people are going to be looking at. And if they look unnatural, they're going to distract from your story. And so you have to sort of beware of those. And then the idea of, does your grass have a bright blue club light on it that you don't want to neutralize?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are you looking at grass during the day? Are you looking at it in the morning? Are you looking at it at night? Are you looking at it at like midnight? It's like that grass is going to be completely different under all those circumstances.
That's a great point. I mean, grass, what, it probably at night will go to black, basically, because it has a ton of shadows in it, you know? So
that's right.
Or it potentially will be less saturated, because the way that your eyes work is they're not going to perceive the same level of saturation at night than they will during the day.
So I think the lesson here is that while the scopes are really useful and a necessary tool, they're not a grading monitor. They're not a substitute for a screen and your eyes and your brain.
Absolutely. Otherwise, somebody would just say, hey, I'll just go by the numbers and plug them in and I'll be done. But that's why that's why we have jobs, is because we...
You're right.
Right.
Billy, I totally agree. Well, how about this, guys? I'm sure people are chomping at the bit as to what to buy. What do you think? Should we do the Coloristos waveform monitor buying guide or what?
I mean, I see a lot of ultrascopes out there these days, too. A lot of people using them. And
yeah,
the software scopes and what they can do as compared to a hardware scope and the price difference. I mean, I'd say like the high level things that I do with the Tektronix scope, I use maybe 5 to 10% of the time. So, I mean, my advice
and
to
you're
people,
doing that because and you're doing that because you're using it for broadcast work. Whereas if you weren't doing broadcast work, those tools wouldn't necessarily be a big factor for you.
That is true.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great first point. Why don't we say this? If you are going to buy a product of like this type, just like your deliverable on your project, you know, where do you need to end up is going to be a critical part of it, the decision. Yeah.
Well, that's an important thing. If you're grading for DI and, you know, a scope in terms of what the information you're going to get back is not necessarily as important from a technical perspective, but it does help. I mean, people doing DI still like to have scopes just as a reference point, you know? So if you're doing a DI, ideally you'd have something that supports, you know, 2K and RGB and all and 444 input. So that's going to be naturally be a more expensive solution than something that's only going to do 422 YUV signals for broadcast or for, you know, just day-to-day web grading even. So a lot of our listeners are probably using software scopes in DaVinci or Scratch or whatever products. Those are generally okay. The issues are that you're not looking at something that's being output through a signal path. So you're not really seeing the signal levels. You're seeing what the internal levels within the app are.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so that can sometimes be more information that's actually there, or it can be slightly different information. And it's also taking up system resources. You know, you're eating up a couple of CPU cycles or a couple of GPU cycles, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, rendering those scopes. So you're going to get a little bit more performance putting all those resources onto an outside box. And, you know, I mentioned a little bit that the cheapest solution I could think of is probably like something like Scopebox, which costs you $99 for the software, and something like a Mac Mini to run it, which costs you $600 or $700. And then some kind of HDSDI Thunderbolt input device. So something like I think Blackmagic has a couple of new little small adapters that are like $200 or something. So you could get one of those and have a solution that's going to be about $1,000 that's going to give you everything up to HD 422 10-bit input.
So basically, like if we were to break it down, would you guys agree with the idea of, we'll say, colorists early in their career and people doing output for web, and then you'd have television and then possibly film and digital intermediate work. Would you say those are three good major groups that we can speak to for people who need scopes?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point, Jason, that you have to know where you're going to end up. I think that that's really going to tell you. I mean, that tells you about the whole workflow in general, you know, the speed of your drives, the monitor that you use, all of that stuff. It's like where you end up will tell you what you need to buy.
I mean, if you're doing for broadcast work, you're really going to want hardware scopes with the high refresh, and then also gamut alarms and error alarms that, you know, will alert you to where things are off. You know, Josh, you have the techs, right? I have the leaders. And, you know, they'll give you feedback in terms of gamut issues and luminance issues, and you'll get immediate and high refresh feedback from those devices. But you're looking at 10 grand minimum for those things.
And so for to kind of take care of the web use and, you know, colorists who are early in their career, would we say that largely they can get away with software scopes? And then if they can move up to like a scope box or an ultrascope solution, that's a great next step. Would that be a good idea?
I think for web people, they're just, they need a scope to find out how to make their images look good rather than stay within some sort of a legal limit. Because God knows what the web is. It's just whatever, you know, whoever's monitor at whatever. So there's, it's literally the Wild West with that stuff. So who knows? I mean, the best that I go by is maybe sRGB, which is close to Rec 709. Mm-hmm. So you could use that as a guideline. So maybe use the same ideas that you have for broadcast and go by sRGB. But I mean, as far as legalization and all that stuff, you don't need to worry about it unless you figure that somebody's going to look at YouTube on their Apple TV.
Well, even then, like, there's a difference between the levels that are allowed for broadcast and the levels that consumers can use at home. You don't have the broadcast level issues when you're playing something on an Apple TV. So having something like a legalizer in the chain is not nearly as important. But I personally think, you know, even for the web, I think, you know, working 709 and working on an external monitor is a great way to kind of go about it. It doesn't have to be too expensive. And in those cases, I think, you know, it gives you the opportunity to have a set of scopes, and you can have something that's fairly cost effective that is going to give you scope monitoring on that signal path. So you'll see that same signal that you're seeing on your monitor represented on your scopes.
And then film, like, what do we say? Like, if you were going to be a high-end film colorist, or if you were saying you would go into a typical DI color mm-hmm. bay, you know, what do you guys think you would find?
A lot of the high-end DI hardware has really nice software scopes, and that's much more accurate for the DI world, because the DI world, you're dealing with DPX outputs or DCP outputs, so you're dealing with file-based outputs that are coming directly from the machine. So you're not dealing with the issue of what's the signal path and how's the signal path affecting my image. So those software scopes are a little more informative than they might be otherwise. And then I do see a lot of hardware scopes in those instances where they're using some dedicated hardware scopes that support 2K resolution, support RGB, support even support XYZ scoping. So they can, it basically applies a lot to the XYZ to convert it back to RGB value. So you can look at the RGB parade and whatnot from an XYZ signal that's going to the projector.
Well, it's clear that there's a lot of issues that have to do with scopes and, you know, what choices you make, and they're infinitely complex machines, but really they're there to make sure that, you know, as I said before, they're a map usually for where you want to go and what you're looking for, and make sure that you're in and out of a particular range. So, yeah, great conversation, guys. This is definitely a meaty issue.
Yeah, it's something that you could make several podcasts on alone, much less even the time spent getting proficient with it. So,
well, I hope we gave our listeners here a good starting point to sort of explore this, and you know, we'd love to hear your comments on Lift Gamma Gain on the podcast. You can my name is Juan Salvo. You can find me at juansalvo.com, and I'm also on Twitter at @j_salvo.
And I'm Jason Myris. I'm a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles. You can catch me also on Lift Gamma Gain, where we'll be talking about this some more until our next podcast, and also on jasonmyris.com.
And I'm Josh Petok. You can see me on Twitter as @joshpetok, and I'm hanging out on Lift Gamma Gain as well.
We'll see you guys next time.